Kate Murphy, an assistant managing editor at Fortune magazine, has written a book called Crazy 08, How a Cast of Cranks, Rogues, Boneheads, and Magnates Created the Greatest Year in Baseball History. Although none of them were around a century ago, today's Cubs fans might really agree, because 1908 was the last year their team won the World Series. Actually, Ms. Murphy makes a strong and entertaining case for her contention, no matter what team you root for. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to my show to talk about her book, which is published by Smithsonian Books / Collins. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
So are you a Cubs fan?
Actually, I'm more of a Mets fan, but I'm a baseball fan most of all.
What got you thinking about 1908?
Well, I've always been a baseball fan, and I had a strong interest in early baseball history. Around 2003, I was looking to write a book, just more or less for the experience of it, having spent my career as a journalist. And it was actually my father who suggested I look into the 1908 season. He said, you know, I think some interesting stuff happened that year. And then I began looking into it, and of course he was right.
And then you make the claim that it was the season baseball came of age.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
In what sense?
In 1908, baseball in a lot of ways was living off its 19th century patrimony. And I believe that 1908 is the year it became clear, even to the owners, who were not the most enlightened people, that this could no longer be the case. And so the most concrete, so to speak, example of this is that in 1908, ground is broken on Shibe Park in Philadelphia, which is the first modern baseball ballpark. It's steel and concrete. It's fireproof. It holds 25,000 people. It survived until 1976. And compared to the shabby wooden fire traps the rest of the teams were playing in, you know, Shibe Park looks absolutely splendid.
So it suggests that the owners realized that the game was here to stay, and that they should do something more than build flimsy ballparks that you say did go up in flames on a regular basis.
Repeatedly. I mean, the Polo Grounds that your listeners might remember, the one that saw Willie Mays, Bobby Thompson, the amazing Mets, that was actually the last Polo Grounds. Its predecessor burnt down in 1911. And there were terrible tragedies at the ballpark. Also, the game was getting more popular, and you had these ballparks that held, you know, 10, 15,000 people, and you would get 20, even 30, and in one memorable game, 40,000 people. And what you would do is you would rope them in the outfield or down the foul lines. You can't sell concessions to those people. A lot of them sneak in, and the owners began to realize they're leaving money on the table. And then and now, this is not something they're willing to do.
Now, we know that this was a serious year because it was the year that Take Me Out to the Ball Game was composed.
Well, which really makes it one of the most important years in American history, not just baseball history.
But you're making that claim here as well, although you also reveal that for many people, the historic events of the year paled in comparison to what was going on in baseball. Rube Goldberg, in fact, you have a little poem by Rube Goldberg, in which he says he's not even paying much attention. Nobody he knows is paying much attention to the presidential race, William Howard Taft versus William Jennings Bryan. In those days, everybody had to have three names.
Yes.
But they all were aware of John McGraw.
Yes, John McGraw was probably the single most compelling character in the game. He came up with the Orioles in the 1890s, was part of those great Orioles teams, great and frankly deplorable in terms of their character and behavior. And then he came to New York in 1902. By 1904, he'd won their first World, 1905, won their first World Series, became the toast of the town. New York then was also the media capital and the commercial capital of the country. And you do get noticed more in New York than in most other places. And just simply the force of John McGraw's character made him probably the single most compelling character in the game.
You do get a sense in looking over the historic things that you include in this book that this was a year of transition for America. On the one hand, it's the year that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid died, but also the year that Henry Ford introduced the Model T, that the NAACP was founded. So there was a lot of stuff going on in that year. But for baseball, it was still the time when the Yankees weren't called the Yankees, the Dodgers weren't called the Dodgers, and the Cleveland team was called the Naps.
Well, the whole issue of team nicknames is kind of interesting in that it was very informal. Typically, a team would go through numerous names, and then for some reason, one would stick. So, for example, in before 1908, what we now know of as the Yankees, they were founded officially as the Highlanders, in part because their ballpark was on the highest piece of ground in Manhattan, up around 168th Street. But by 1908, they're still officially the Highlanders, but they're generally called the Yankees. If you look at the newspaper coverage of the era, they basically use the term Yankees. It has a little more oomph to it, and it's shorter for headlines, which is probably why. The Cubs, 1908 is the year they really, for certain, become the Cubs. They put an emblem of the bear on the uniform, and that nickname, which has been coalescing for some years, becomes permanent. And interestingly, that's the year Red Sox start. Previous to 1908, the Boston AL team had been known as the Pilgrims, the Bean Eaters, the Somersets, the Taylors. Before the season, the owner of the Red Sox jokingly, but semi-seriously, says, we need a new name for our team. He changes the uniform from blue Sox to red and says, how about we call them the Red Sox? And that's how you got the Red Sox.
I'm sure there are a lot of Highlanders fans out there that are happy to hear that they used to be called the Bean Eaters. How much has the game changed since that time? Was this, would we pretty much recognize the game?
Totally. And that's one of the rather delightful things about baseball. If we went back to a football game or a basketball game in 1908, we would not be impressed. I think the play would look very crude. In fact, it would be so different, it would almost seem like a different game. Basketball games in 1908 had scores of, like 20 to 14. So much, much more primitive. Baseball has really been evolving since the 1840s, when the first rules were put down. And that's a good long time. That gives you 60-odd years to 1908. The rules have changed very little, other than the designated hitter, which I personally abhor.
That's only one league anyway.
Yeah, and it's only the junior circuit. The mound was lowered, the abolition of freak pitches. But the game is identical. And if you could take me out to a ballpark in 1908, and I would love to be there, I think the game would be thoroughly familiar.
Although there was only one umpire in many games, sometimes two, and that really must have changed things. There had to be a lot of blown calls if the umpire was standing behind the pitcher, as they do in softball, and then had to follow the trajectory of the ball. He didn't see anything that was going on behind him.
What would happen is if there were no men on base, the umpire would be behind the catcher, and then man on base, he'd go behind the pitcher. And yes, they totally blew calls. And there's several games in which clearly the umpire could not see two things happening at once. For example, a runner going into second while one goes home. You just can't see both things at the same time. And they would simply have to flip a mental coin and pick. And sometimes they were wrong.
And sometimes the catchers would trip the batter as he was getting out of the batter's box.
Absolutely, whatever it takes. And this happened in a game in which apparently a reporter said to the Cubs catcher, look, if you've got a man on first and the umpire's behind the pitcher and you hit the ball, the umpire is going to turn to follow the ball. Why can't the catcher trip up the runner? And the catcher said, well, that's a terrific idea. So he did it, and then the opposing team did it, and then they each did it one more time, and the next day there were two umpires on the field.
So when did we wind up with, I think it was three until fairly recently.
I don't know when it went to four. I think that might have been the 70s.
Yeah. But it was three ever since I could remember when I was a kid.
Yeah. What happened in 1908 was there was all these contested games. Both pennant races went down to the last day, and it began, again, even baseball's management, of which I frankly have a very low opinion, even they recognized that this is ridiculous. The game is too rich, too sophisticated. The stakes are too high to be, settling pennant-deciding games with one umpire in the field. And after 1908, both teams went to a two-umpire system that actually began in 1910. Four seems like a good number to me.
Although there were some unique things. It's the only season where a game ended in a tie and the only one where someone stole first base.
Well, there might have been there was at least one other case of stealing first base, but I love this example because it's so illuminating of the Giants. They're winning, I believe, 7-2 in the eighth inning. In 1908, which is the second lowest scoring season in history, a 5-run lead in the eighth inning is like a 10-run lead now. There's men on first and third, and the giant first baseman, Fred Tenney, he dashes to second on the front end of a double steal. You hope to draw the throw, and the guy in third comes home. So he dashes to second, but the catcher doesn't throw. So double steal thwarted. So on the next pitch, Fred Tenney goes back to first.
So that he could try
the whole thing again. And then on the next pitch, he goes to second, draws the throw, and the double steal works. But the thing about
the catcher has to be real stupid to not figure this out.
Well, there's ways to defend against the double steal. I think the poor guy was just so befuddled. The Giants were playing the Cardinals, which was by far the worst team in the National League. So they're playing the worst team. They have a big lead late in the game, and they pull this kind of nonsense. It's a kind of in-your-face insult and was regarded as such even at the time. And it really says something about how the Giants saw the game. They didn't care.
But there were a lot of players who played hard. After all, Ty Cobb was a star on the Detroit team, which was the team that faced the Cubs in the World Series. And he was notorious for coming in to second spikes high. It was a time of golden age of players, wasn't it? Not just Ty Cobb. You have Honus Wagner, Christy Mathewson. Cy Young is still pitching. Mordechai Three-Finger Brown, Napoleon Lejoie, and the Cubs double play combination is legendary.
Tinker to Evers to Chance. Although the irony is, if you actually look at the statistics, and frankly that's probably not fair when you're actually describing a mythical trio, they didn't turn that many double plays. That said, they were a very good double play combination. There were fewer people on base because the Cubs were a good team. They had one of the great pitching staffs in history. And there's every indication that when they needed to have a double play and had the opportunity, that they turned it with flair. They were regarded as the finest infield of the time.
My guest is Kate Murphy, C-A-I-T Murphy. Her book, Crazy 08, How a Cast of Cranks, Rogues, Boneheads, and Magnates Created the Greatest Year in Baseball History. It's published by Smithsonian Books / Collins, because it's an imprint of HarperCollins. The bonehead is an important part of this whole story, isn't it?
Oh, it's huge. I consider 1908 the year that baseball sort of made the turn for modernity. And the hinge, if I can mix the metaphors a little bit, is September 23rd, 1908. The Cubs are playing the Giants in the Polo Grounds. The Cubs are half a game behind. And this is the most intense rivalry in baseball, without question. Bottom of the ninth, tie game. The Giants have men on first and third. The batter hits a clean single. The man on third lopes home. And the man on first sees the winning run score. And he sees 20,000 fans pouring onto the field in jubilation. So the man on first, a teenage rookie named Fred Merkel, rather than going all the way to second, he lights off for the clubhouse. The Cubs second baseman, Johnny Evers, of Tinker to Evers to Chance fame, gets a ball from somewhere. It is by no means clear it was a game ball. Steps on second base and screams at the ump. Merkel never touched second. I just forced him out. It's three outs and the run doesn't score. Now, the thing is, what Merkel had done was technically wrong, no question, but it was also common practice at the time, so this was not an easy decision for the umpires. Nevertheless, there were two on the day. They consult, they agree with Evers, they call Merkel out, and the game is a tie. And at the end of the season, the Cubs and the Giants have identical records. They have to replay the Merkel game for the pennant. And sadly, poor Fred Merkel, who of course I've never met, but I just really like the guy.
Well, a guy with the nickname Bonehead Merkel
from then
on. For
the rest of his life.
He's 19 years old.
And it just haunts him for the rest of his life. I have two pictures in the book, one of Fred Merkel at the beginning of the 1908 season and one sort of 13 years later. And the difference between the two images is just haunting.
Now, this was a tight pennant race. Actually, six teams were in contention just 2 days with two games to go. So how did it sort itself out? The Merkel game, I guess, determined that the Cubs beat out the Giants, But with the Detroit Tigers, did they have a great team other than Ty Cobb?
Oh, sure. So three teams in each league were in contention with 2 days left. Let's go to the American League first. Detroit won the pennant, followed closely by Cleveland and Chicago. Basically, what happened is Detroit won 10 games in a row beginning on September 25th. That got them far enough ahead that they were able to hang on. The Chicago White Sox and the Cleveland Indians had one of the most memorable games of the season in either league, and what I consider the greatest pitching duel in history, in the last week of the pennant race.
That was Ed Walsh and Addie Joss?
Both Hall of Famers, not well-known Hall of Famers, but Ed Walsh won 40 years that year for the Chicago White Sox and had perhaps the best spitball ever. Addie Joss was a wonderful pitcher for the Cleveland Indians, who died 3 years later of tubercular meningitis quite suddenly. But they were both fine pitchers at their prime. October 2nd, playing in Cleveland, Ed Walsh strikes out 15, gives up a single unearned run, and loses to Addie Joss, who merely pitches a perfect game. It must have just been absolutely thrilling.
Well, pitching had to have been better in those days anyway, because now in a time of pitch counts, you can't imagine a pitcher working both ends of a doubleheader, pitching every inning and throwing two shutouts. I remember Don Newcomb started both ends of a doubleheader, but he didn't make it all the way to the second game.
And that's a good long time ago. But Ed Reulbach did that, again, late in the season, September 26th, for the Cubs. It's the only time it's been done. But again, think of Ed Walsh of the White Sox, who pitched 464 innings. That's double the load of what today would be called a workhorse pitcher. Just one anomaly about the American League race is that Detroit hung on ahead of Cleveland, and yet the thing is, they both had the same number of wins. Detroit won the pennant, even though it had the same number of wins, because it was unable to replay. It was either a tie game or a rainout, so they had one less loss. And that's a terrible result. And ditto for the White Sox. They were unable to replay two games. And if they had been able to replay them and won them both, they would have been tied. So again, after 1908, the AL imposes the rule that any games with a bearing on the pennant race must be played. Just another example of how baseball is growing up.
We should also point out for non-baseball fans that 1908 was the year that Lyndon Baines Johnson and Milton Berle were born. Meanwhile, the game, you say, was pretty much established from then on. And the president's race, well, William Jennings Bryan didn't win for the third time.
He's become the sort of Chicago Cubs of presidential races. You know, tries hard but doesn't quite make it.
Kate, this book is a lot of fun. And whether it was the greatest baseball season of all time or whether it was 1947 or some other year, it was a pretty terrific year. And I thank you so much for talking with us about Crazy 08, how a cast of cranks, rogues, boneheads, and magnates created the greatest year in baseball history. It's published by Smithsonian Books/Collins. And does this mean you are going to write more books about baseball? You're going to go back to writing about business?
Well, my day job is still writing about business. I wouldn't mind trying another book. I'm not sure it'll be about baseball. I love doing this project, but even for a baseball fan, spending 4 years writing a book about it, I feel a little drowned. So maybe I'll look into something else.
On the other hand, the reviews must make you feel very good.
Oh, I've been thrilled. The reviews have been uniformly positive, and some of them almost embarrassingly so. If anyone wants to see them, there is a website, crazy08.com, where I'm posting reviews and other things.